We'll start off, I'll ask you your full name.
John Marshall White.
And where were you born?
St. Joseph, Missouri, Sisters Hospital.
Oh, and do you want to tell us when you were born?
June 18th, 1947.
Do you know how and when your family came to St. Joe?
Well, it depends on which segment of the family you're talking about. Okay. My grandfather, Marshall, migrated here from West Virginia, from Turkey Creek, West Virginia. He was born in 1880. And in 1911, he married my grandmother, Nauman. And she was born up in Craig. And they settled here in St. Joe. They had... Well, that takes care of my mother's side of the family. My father's side of the family, Carl White, moved down here from Davenport, Iowa, and married my grandmother, who was a Gaines, who grew up just across the county line in Andrew County. But we had people living here, from the 1850s on. My grandmother White's... great uncle was Armstrong Beatty, who was 5 times mayor of the city. So we can go back a ways.
What part of St. Joe did you grow up in?
Midtown. I grew up basically at 1928 Clay. I mean, we lived a few other places around town before we settled in that house, but through grade school, 1928 Clay, and then high school, 3409 Beck Road.
And growing up, what was your neighborhood like?
Well, I was part of the Clay Street Mafia. In the 1900 block, in that general area, there were 38 kids. And we all ran around together and did things together and ate in each other's houses and... played havoc in each other's houses.
What are some of your earliest childhood memories?
Well, what a great place it was to grow up in. I had a grandmother who lived downtown, Grandmother White. She lived on 7th Street. And that was just a block from church. We had the hotel, we had the movie theaters. We had the YMCA. So as a kid, mother would tell me what time to be home for supper, and I'd better be home for supper. But she wasn't worried about me. You know, she knew the general area where I was going to be, and that was fine. Now, as I got towards the 8th grade, I had to be corralled a little bit because I would ride my bike all over town. And one of my greatest accomplishments in the 8th grade was that I got to the point where I could ride without any gears up King Hill. And to me, that was a major accomplishment. I loved riding the parkways.
Can you tell me a little bit about your parents?
My father was a haberdasher. Helped start Nash Roads, which was a men's store in the late 50s over at 7th and Felix. And my grandmother was also involved in that store. And then he went on to Townsend Wall, where he became vice president at Townsend Wall and a buyer for various departments. Traveled to New York usually 4 times a year. And mother would stay at home until she decided to go back to work when we got older. And she worked as a phlebotomist, a vampire, taking blood from people.
And what were their names?
Jack and Virginia White.
And what about your grandparents? Do you remember?
Well, yeah, my grandfather lived to be 100. Theodore Guy White, or Guy Marshall, excuse me, and everybody called him Guy. For some reason, he was never Ted, but he was Guy. And he was president of the Board of Public Works for a number of years back in the late 30s and early 40s during World War II. Ethel Lavisse Nauman Marshall. And she lived to be, I believe, 85. And then Ruth Gaines White. There's some dispute about this, but her birth certificate says Marion Ruth Gaines White. And I don't think she liked Marion. And so she always went by Ruth. And then Carl White. And I think it was Lewis, but I can't remember for sure. I never knew him. He died of leukemia about late 1944, I think. This was his ring and my father's ring and then mine. Well, we rotated Sundays after church, either at Grandmother Marshall's where she cooked fried chicken or whatever else she was feeling like cooking that day. And, you know, the wonderful meals around the dining room table, and I have that dining room table now. Or we went with my grandmother to the Hotel Rubidoux. Grandmother White, we'd meet her at the Hotel Rubidoux and the circus buffet. And I could eat all the prime rib I wanted for, I think it was $3.95 for Sunday circus buffet. And I loved rare prime rib. And they had saddles of it. And there was a chef there with a knife this long carving the meat every Sunday. So, and there was a salad bar and there were vegetables and everything you could possibly want. But the meat was wow.
So was that thing to do when you were younger, was on Sundays, well, or special occasions you would go there?
Yeah. Some special occasions were at our house too. I mean, the family would come in from Chicago and Kansas City, and we would, mother had a sister and a brother. She had two brothers, but the one I'm named for died in the Philippines on the Bataan Death March.
What schools did you attend?
Edison and Central. In those days, there was only one middle school. I think that was Bliss. They were snobs as far as we were concerned. Seventh and eighth grade were kind of special in elementary school because you were in the school safety patrol and, you know, you did other things. And there was scouting too, so.
Bliss Middle School, is it no longer?
No, I believe it's a housing for some people, I'm not sure.
Where was it?
Oh. It's southeast of Central and west of Mark Twain, but I can't remember the exact. I could go find it, but I think it's on Lafayette, but I wouldn't swear to it. Probably about 30th maybe.
When you were like a teenager, did you have any high school jobs or anything?
Oh yeah, I started working when I was about 14. Started as a busboy at the Oakford Tea Room on 7th Street next to Mantrex and just up from the Federal Bakery where you could smell donuts and cookies and cakes and pies all day long. Little old ladies in hairnets were in there working, and it's a corner 7th and Felix. It was on the north east corner of the intersection and had huge glass windows all around. And the ladies wore hairnets and you could watch them working all day long in the bakery. It was something. So, I went to work for the grocery stores and joined the union. And started at Green Hills number 5, which is up on St. Joe Avenue. I'd ride the bus up there after school at Central. I'd take the bus, walk over to Jewel Street, catch the bus downtown to 6th and Francis, and catch the bus from there on St. Joe Avenue up to 5th Avenue, where I'd get off and walk over to the store. The store's still there, but it's moved. In my day, it was in an empty field today, and it flooded, I think, at one time, and so they moved it right next to the field and built it higher up, and it's still operating. Worked there for a couple of years, and then I moved to Beatty's number, I think it's number 9, at 19th and Jewel, which is a dance studio today, with Jack Meredith. That was probably the busiest store in town. They actually gave credit, and you could be billed for your groceries there. And they sold liquor by the truckload, because I carried it out to people's cars and trucks. They would come in at certain times of the year and stock up. And liquor and meat. They had 14 butchers in the store. And liquor and meat, everything else was a come on for the liquor and the meat. And they were very successful while Meredith ran the store. Rose from a stocker to be a cashier.
Did you go off to college after high school?
No. Graduated from Central in 66, the 100th graduating class. And went to junior college the next year. And was dating a girl. And she'd come back from MU. And so she was doing her second year there at JC, which is just up the street here, now apartment buildings. And in the spring of 67, Vista came through. And I talked with my girlfriend about how I was going to join Vista. And finally, after several weeks of this, she said, either do it or shut up. So I went and signed up. And I was living at the YMCA at 10th and Farron at that for my freshman year in high school. And lived on the 3rd floor. I think I paid $10 a week for my room. So, and I worked Saturdays at Hurd Auction. It was down on 3rd Street in those days. And my grandmother was the bookkeeper for Hurd's. She kept 3 sets of books simultaneously. She kept the store's books, the buyer's books, and the seller's books. And if you were a buyer, you could come up and check out at any time while the auction was going on, and she'd never miss a beat on any of it. And it was just the job, and she was good at it. And so I lifted stuff up to the podium, the platform, where Walter Roth and Harry Hurd, and sometimes Gilbert Hurd, his brother, would auction off things. And Betty Jane Roth, Walter's wife, would call the audience getting the bids and say, yeah, I got this, or got, you know. And we would mark the tags as they came off the stand and carry them back. And if it was a regular buyer, we'd put it in their area. If it wasn't a regular buyer, we'd put it in another area where we'd just have to hunt for it and stuff like that. But we did that every Saturday morning and sometimes into the afternoon if we had a big sale. And so that's how I learned antiques. And my grandmother was a lover of antiques. But where were we? Oh, school in Vista. So they called me at the Y in May and said they had an opening if I wanted to go to Georgia. Vista is the equivalent of the Peace Corps, only it serves in the United States. And it was part of the Office of Economic Opportunity in those days. Kennedy had started it. And So I went to Georgia for training in Atlanta, the Southern Theological, the old Southern Theological Seminary, on the grounds. The school had closed, I believe, but they leased it to Vista, and I can't remember the name of the corporation. It was a national corporation that was providing the trainers and everything. And we trained, and then I was selected to go to Carroll County, Georgia. It was a major Vista program. And I worked there for a year, and during the course of the year, that's how I met my wife, because I had to take groceries down to the Head Start program in Whitesburg, Georgia. And the first time I took groceries down in a GSA vehicle, it was a panel truck, I pulled up and went in the door, and all the kids are on the floor on their little rugs, and the only light in there was over in the back corner. It was a naked wire with a bulb and hanging down in the back, and the only thing it shone on was Melanie. And that's the first time I saw her, and I was hit like a thunderbolt. And so we dated on and off for the year I was there, and then I got drafted. And before I left, I asked her to marry me, and she said no. I was too radical for her. And so, but we stayed in touch and everything. And eventually I called her again and asked her to marry me again, and she said yes. And I went down after boot camp, and we got engaged, and I think that was in November of that year. That would be November of 67. And flew up here for Thanksgiving dinner with her mother and her to meet our folks. And we ate Thanksgiving at grandmother's house over on Lincoln Street. Grandmother Marshall and Grandfather Marshall. And everybody got to meet them. And then I went off to A school in San Diego. And at the completion of A school, I called her. I had orders to Guam, which she didn't know where it was, and I didn't really know where it was. I knew it was in the Pacific, but I said, so we can get married in the next 2 weeks, or we can wait 2 years. And she said, come on down. So I flew down, and mother flew down from here, and we got married on a Friday night and drove to Callaway Gardens and honeymooned, and came back on a Sunday and dropped her off and picked my mother up, flew up to St. Joe, said goodbye to everybody, and dropped mother off. And then I went on to catch a plane out of Travis in San Francisco and went to Guam, and we were married. She finished school, and that summer after she finished school, she came up here for my sister's wedding, and then she flew on out to join me in Guam, and we had another 14-month honeymoon living in half a Quonset hut on Guam. And after that, I got sent to sea. I was in Airedale first, then I got sent to sea in the Black Shoe Navy. And so she went home, and I would fly home on leave every now and then and visit. And after that, I got stationed again in Cecil Field in Jacksonville, Florida. When that was over with, I came home. We bought a house on the GI Bill in Sonoy, Georgia. I went to school at West Georgia, where she had gone to school, West Georgia University, although it was still a college in those days. And then we got jobs in Kentucky. And so we went to Kentucky for 10 years and lived there and in Frankfort. And I was started as an archivist for the state of Kentucky. And then I became a court administrator in the state of Kentucky. And then in 1986, 20 years later, I come home. And we've been back ever since. We bought a house on Main Street We've lived there longer than we've lived any place. And I've spent the last 20 years working for the paper.
So how did you become interested in journalism?
Well, I don't know that I had become interested in journalism. I'd done a couple of books, but we had a fella here by the name of Bob Unger, and I'd just done a book on the history of the Baptist Church, and I wrote it in past tense just as an exercise to see if I could do it. And he called me up one day and asked me if I wanted a job, and I thought about it for a year. Scared the living daylights out of me, because most of the people in the news business were young, like you, and I wasn't sure I could keep up with them. I mean, by then I was 50. So, but I went in one day and I said, "Is that job offer still available? I know it's been a year, but I had to think about it. I'll take it." And so we had some meetings and came to an agreed salary. I actually took a salary lower than what they wanted to offer me, because again, I wasn't sure I could do it. And we started working, and I was pretty raw in the beginning, but I think I took to it, and my writing ability seemed to be like I was on a skyrocket, and I liked that. So I stayed with it, and I'll probably stay with it if my health holds for another 5 years. I'll be 75 then and retire.
So naturally, from my perspective, if we can talk more about kind of your experiences being a reporter in St. Joe, is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. What are some of your favorite stories and events that you've covered?
Well, they kind of all cloud together. I don't know that I have favorites particularly. I enjoy doing the veteran stories sometimes. I did one that I think I did a pretty good job on about a veteran who survived on one of the aircraft carriers in World War II. And I found others who needed to have their stories told. There are very few of them left now, but there were a lot more when I started, of course. That was 20 years ago. I guess my favorite was the series I did on Dwight Scroggins, the prosecutor. When I first took over at the courthouse, I discovered a number of things, one right after the other, about the prosecutor. He was the only person in the courthouse getting a car allowance, and then I found out he got 13 months allowances in the previous year, and 13 isn't equal to 12, and so I wrote him up for that. And then I found he had a $1,000 party at the Benton Club, and I wrote him up for that, and he's never had a Christmas party at the Benton Club since then. And then I found out he was the highest paid prosecutor in the year, and that in the state, and that cost him, I think, about $20,000 that he had to give back to the county. So we weren't exactly on the best terms in those days. But I've enjoyed writing about the guard, the air guard here especially, is an important part of the Air Force. They're totally integrated. The unit is not only composed of members of the Air Guard, it's composed of reservists from the Air Force and active duty Air Force out there. They do the training for anybody who flies transport planes pretty much in the world, in the Allied side of the world at any rate. People come here from 16 foreign countries every year to train out there to learn how to fly. They're also, as far as I know, the only guard unit in the country that has a second base in another state. They actually have a base in Arizona, even though it's a Missouri Air National Guard unit, because they use the base in Arizona to train to fly in the mountains. And they use the base here to fly on the plains. And those are two different types of flying, and they train both. So, and then they go on active duty all over the world. I gather from talking to the Adjutant General this spring that about 1,000 of them will be leaving sometime soon to go to the Far East for probably 6 months. So, and they've done air shows, and that's been fun. I've gotten to fly in a V-17 and a Ford Trimotor, which was the first commercial passenger plane built by Ford. That was kind of fun. So I've had some experiences. And then one day they were having races across country for these old biplanes. And I got to do a story because they got diverted. Kansas City was bad weather for some reason. They got diverted to St. Joe, and they came in out of the clouds. And it was like history was a time machine was kicking these planes out. And I got to see about 25 different biplanes from pre-World War II. Some of them had very interesting histories as well. So that's been fun. The flood stories have been fascinating. We've had a number of floods over the years. I write about the river. And I wrote about museums quite a bit, and I enjoyed some of that. And then the paper let me do a book on postcards. And we just agreed to do another one in 5 years. So we just renewed the series this January. So hopefully in 5 years we'll be doing another book.
That's awesome. Your postcards, because you do series in the news press.
Yes.
Postcards from the past. Why did you begin doing that series?
Well, I had, when we lived in Kentucky, I had started collecting St. Joe postcards. Because we came home usually at least twice a year, and sometimes three and four times a year. So we were familiar with the town and everything, to see family and visit and all. I always had friends living here. And I've always been a collector. So we live in a museum. Our house was built in 1867. I have the postcard. I've given the first postcard collection to the St. Joe Historical Society at Rue du Row, but I've built another one up since then. We have an art collection, over 225 paintings. Most of those will go to the St. Joe Museum, and most of them are St. Joe artists. And if they're not St. Joe artists, they're artists we personally know. There are a few exceptions, but you know, we have antique furniture. Like I said, I have my grandparents' dining room set, the Marshalls. I have my grandmother's sideboards. My wife collects miniature books. I collect books. We gave the library a collection of St. Joe books. We gave the university a collection of Southern writers and private press books. And we gave the University of Missouri a collection of printed ephemera from presses. But we had to build more bookcases, and we're still out of book space because we still collect. So it's just the way it is. And then I collect stamps. So I'm building a St. Joe collection of stamps for the Pony Express Museum. Because basically it's a postal museum, and that's what the Pony Express did, was carry mail. Well, the average Pony Express letters cost at least a quarter of a million, and they can go up over $1 million on some of them. So they're not going to get many new Pony Express letters. But they can tell the story of how the mail brought the world to St. Joe, and how St. Joe went out to the world through the mail. And I have letters from all over the world addressed to people in St. Joe, and I have letters sent from St. Joe to places all over the world. So it's getting to be a nice collection. And I've also trying to collect mail. It doesn't matter whether it went out of St. Joe or just stayed in St. Joe, but the envelope has the name of a business or a person in the return address, just to try and show the wide variety there of that sort of thing. I was real pleased recently. I got a small collection of envelopes, used envelopes, that have 1.5 cent stamps on them. And they're all for in the 30s and early 40s Christmas cards mailed in town, basically. And for Christmas cards, if you didn't seal the flap, the post office would let you mail them at a lower rate. And in those days, it was 1.5 cents. And they had a 1.5 cent stamp. Yeah, you obviously had to buy two stamps, at least in even numbers, so that there weren't any, I mean, because we haven't had a half cent coin since the 1840s or 50s, I think. But we did at one time have a half cent coin. Of course, a penny in those days used to be this big. I enjoy writing the stories sometimes. Sometimes they get kind of sad, but the crime stories where we have trials or we have people pleading guilty and getting sentenced. I'll be doing that this afternoon. The girl who murdered with another guy, a girl up at Krug Park, will be sentenced this afternoon. Her partner got life in prison. I personally think she's as culpable as he was. So I'm hoping she'll get the same sentence, but she may not. We'll just have to see what the judge decides, because it's a different judge. And I try and show the nuances and things as much as possible in those stories, things that the reader might put the reader in the courtroom like they were there. I try to paint pictures with words. So
after you took the job from News Press, why did you continue to?
I enjoy it. And you got to have a reason to get up in the morning. I can't do nothing. I mean, you might as well start dying if you're not going to do something. So.
Now, over the course of your career with the News Press, you've covered kind of different areas as you were.
Yeah.
Is that something that you would kind of, you've done this for so long, so you wanted to move on to a different area, or how?
Well, they rotate you. When we started, the first thing I did was cops. And we have a night cops and a day cops, and I started as a night cop reporter. But I've been to fires and wrecks all over town. I enjoy doing the fire stories too, because I find that there's a lot to tell there. It's not just the fire itself, it's the people. Sometimes they don't want to talk to you and you can't tell that story. Sometimes they do, and you just keep asking. And sometimes it's the firefighters. I remember one I went to on Christmas Eve. There was 1.5 feet of snow on the ground. And I didn't even try to get all the way to the fire. I parked out on South 22nd Street in a shopping mall where I'd have plenty of room to try and get traction from, because it was still snowing, and hiked across the road down the other road to the fire scene. And we were there until 1 or 2 in the morning, and this was still in the day before we had the television stations. So the fire, they may have been there till 1 or 2 in the morning. I was there until about 9:30. And then I left and came back and got the story in the paper for Christmas Day, because I thought it was important to tell the story of the men who were on duty. Even though it's Christmas Eve, they're not with their families. And what are they doing? They're working. And it was a bad fire. I totaled that. There was no way to save the house. The wind, even with the snow, was not enough moisture to help. They just kept feeding the fire, the oxygen by the wind. So you do those kinds of things. And I've been to car wrecks, you know, and seen brains splattered all over the road and everything else. I mean, where they don't make it and where they do. Seen them ejected and otherwise. Try to tell stories that are realistic about what's happening. I don't want to be gruesome, but on the other hand, I want to write a story that hopefully says, hey, you should have been, you know, this is a case for why you should wear seat belts, or this is a case why you shouldn't drink and drive, or this is a case why you shouldn't be on dope when you're driving, or whatever. Give the officers a chance to explain what's happened and why it's happened and that sort of thing. And it changed gradually. But nobody was writing about museums when I started writing about museums. I found interesting things to write about them. And then the St. Joseph Museum became a front page story, and I was the one who knew what was going on. I loved to write about the libraries. And then the libraries, they were together at one point, and then they had a fight, and they split. And why? And I wrote about that for a number of years. But they fascinated me, and that's where taxpayer money goes. So I started writing about them a little bit more, maybe, than people had previously. And found a beat, actually, within the newsroom that hadn't been particularly covered. I loved writing about the Guard. I was one of the few veterans at the time on the staff. Now I'm the only veteran on the staff. The river fascinated me, and at the time we didn't have anybody writing about the river, so I went out and tried to learn everything I could about the river. And then, as luck would have it, in 97 we had a flood, and we've had a whole bunch since then. And so and I became the regional reporter, and I loved traveling around the country, Northwest Missouri, and seeing all the feeder towns, because St. Joe cannot survive if it doesn't have the feeder communities. And that's what Northwest Missouri is, basically, a feeder for St. Joseph. Now, you don't want to strip those communities. You've got to keep them strong and healthy. But at the same time, some of those people are going to come here. This is the biggest small town you'll ever live in. And there are all sorts of people, and they're all related to communities around here. And it's fascinating to see where those communities are. And things like, I discovered Union Star, which is just northeast of here, okay? Do you know its population hasn't changed? From 1900 to 2000, it was still a city of about 400 people, a little over 400 people. What changed was transportation, and all they had was a school, a bank, a post office, and a few little businesses, and a community fire station. But it's possible now that they may start to grow again, because they're just far enough out that they could have some other businesses if they start to. And there's a gas station there now with a nice community store in it. But the school district gets windmill taxes. And it's made the school was close to having to close. And if the school closed, the community closes, basically. And you'll start to see the population really drop. But it's possible now, if we watch that community, with all the money they're getting from the windmill taxes, they've been able to do things they've never been able to do before, to make improvements, and they're going to continue to make those improvements, I think. And that school could become a magnet for bringing more people to the community. So we'll have to see. But that's a healthy thing that you want to see. Same thing's going over on over in King City, which is a little bit further away. They also get a lot of windmill tax. It's really helped improve the schools there. And that community, I mean, it's a thriving little community. It has a grocery store, too. It has a history museum. It has restaurants. It has nursing homes. That's something that you don't see in Union Star right now. It has a wide variety of businesses and lots of churches. So it could be another community that begins to grow a little bit. Maryville is holding on nicely with the university and some of the businesses they've developed. But we need to see some of that. Over in Atchison County, there is some progress. The city of Rockport has windmills. They're reopening Tarkio University in Tarkio, and Fairfax has the hospital. So all three communities have something different. And the Rockport is also a county seat. And they may start to grow. Tarkio has an airport, and it has Sam Graves, who could help them, I hope. And Fairfax, like I said, has the hospital. So if those three communities start to stabilize and grow again, they could be very vital. That brings me back to St. Joe. And growing up with my dad, when things were going really well, he would take me to lunch at Magoon's. And I knew Benny Magoon. His son ended up being an Edison, and we were a year apart in school. And then we were in the same scout troop. But he had bratwurst and liverwurst and tongue. That's where I learned to eat tongue. And I loved it. And, he was the store, but he had all these people who worked for him, and they were behind the counter, and they knew what they were doing, and they were making stuff at lunchtime like crazy. Now, the Magoon's today, I still go there every now and then, but it isn't like, because it doesn't have Benny, and it's not a Jewish delicatessen, and it was a Jewish delicatessen, and there was a thriving Jewish community in the town at that time. Now they're just barely getting by. Yeah, it's hard to put a minion together even sometimes. But it was a wonderful Jewish community, thriving. They were business owners all over town and stores and all. It was the 50s in St. Joe was still a time when you could have small independent business owners. They weren't getting wealthy, but they were making a good living and getting by. If you were a maiden aunt, chances are you might have learned to make hats, because in 1900, this was a huge hat-making town for ladies' hats, rivaling Paris. Now, it didn't beat it, but it got the attention of people in Paris, and they made hats here. And lots of older ladies who never married had all over town had little hat stores, and women would go in to see what was there and get themselves a new hat for Easter, for their birthday, for their anniversary, for whatever reason, because it's spring and they wanted a new spring bonnet. And ladies wore hats, and these maiden aunts and sisters and things survived. They didn't get wealthy necessarily, but they made a decent living and could close the door and go home and live with another. There could often be two or three of them, okay? Or they had a stationery shop in town, maybe. You know, the families who owned the drugstores all over town. The little ladies who opened up the beauty shops all over town. There used to be 100 of these, and they were in neighborhoods all over town. And AG, the Associated Grocers, had neighborhood grocery stores all over town. We still didn't, the closest thing we had, where we had some big supermarkets. But we didn't have what we have today. They were much smaller. And they were neighborhood stores. Even the supermarkets were neighborhood stores. And you could send Johnny or Susie to the neighborhood AG store to get a pound of butter or a quart of milk or whatever you needed for the night. But nobody wanted to work that hard when those people decided to retire. And so those businesses slowly started to go away. Barbershops were all over town. Shoe repair shops, shoe shines. Most barbershops had a shoe shine shop. And no, the guys didn't make millions, but they made decent money, and they were community places. You knew your barber, your shoeshine guy, and there was usually a beautician in there who would even do your nails. Clean them, fix them, cut them, keep them looking nice, for men even. And even in the 50s, most people kept their cars at home. You got the car out on the weekend. It begins to change towards the end of the 50s, but at the beginning of the 50s, you had a garage and you kept your car in that garage, and Dad got it out and polished it up on Saturday so you could take it to church on Sunday. But you, my father didn't take the car down to Townsend Wall or anything until... oh, maybe the late 50s, and he'd park it at a gas station because he'd have to go places sometimes. But a lot of times he'd walk. I mean, it was only a mile. And as a kid, I walked downtown from my Clay Street house all the time. No big deal. I knew where the dogs were. You know, and I knew where people were, where I walked faster than in other places, but I wasn't really worried. I walked all over town.
So why do you think, or what did you see that kind of contributed to this kind of trend of people starting to get their cars out more?
Well, cars became more and more available, and suburbs began to be developed. We moved to Beck Road, which was a suburb. Didn't have sidewalks. One of the biggest crimes that went on in this town through the 50s and 60s was allowing people to build subdivisions without sidewalks. And we paid for it, and people laughed when the city decided to put a sidewalk in on Farron Street, running all the way out to the university. But it's used. The highway department put sidewalks out Frederick Avenue past I-29. They're used. We need to put the sidewalks back, and we're doing it on the Belt Highway. Slowly but surely, we're getting sidewalks back on the Belt Highway. We need the sidewalks back. It's part of the community. They put the hike and bike trails in, and that's one of the great things the city has done. Now we need to find a way to run them out of town. I want to see a trail running all the way down to Atchison. And if we can get to Atchison, then let's try and get to Weston. Because if we get to Weston, maybe we can connect up to the state trail system, okay? Then you look at running it up towards Maryville, and maybe it can connect with Iowa eventually. There are all sorts of possibilities there that could be fun, healthy, enjoyable, and I don't think they'd be crime-ridden, which some people try and throw in. So we'll see, but I love what the city did on King Hill Avenue and Farron Street when they redid the streets. They did new curbs and they put sidewalks in, and I hope they will continue that throughout town. It can revitalize a whole neighborhood just by the fact that it's doing that. We do need a cleaner town. We went to Iowa last week. It's not the first time we've been to a number of towns, and they're so much cleaner. I just hope we'll see it. We also need to pick some historic neighborhoods and actually push the revitalization of all the old homes in the neighborhood so people can begin to see what it means to have a neighborhood totally revitalized. Instead of a house here and a house there. And we have such wonderful housing stock in this town. We had architects operating here. We had a stained glass window company that was a premier stained glass window company. And you can still find garages in town that have stained glass windows. You can find duplexes that had at least one stained glass or beveled glass window in it. It may be a little diamond-shaped one or a round one or something, but they're somewhere in that house. You know, you didn't build a house without a window of some sort that was special. When we lived on Clay Street, we had the transom above the main picture window in the living room was a rectangle, and it was stained glass. The square window beside the front door was stained glass, so that light at night shining there shined out a beautiful green and light onto the front porch. Porches wouldn't be bad either, come to think of it, because in my grandmother's house, the porch is gone, the house is still there, but somebody took it off, but we had a wraparound front porch, and we sat out there in the rain and watched all sorts of things as we were kids growing up. Sometimes with our grandparents sitting there. My grandfather smoked cigars and would come out and smoke a cigar with me sitting there on the porch, and we'd talk in the rain. But we were dry with this beautiful front porch.
Do you think the kind of the view of revitalization and the trend of it is changing in St. Joseph?
Well, you hope so. It's gone in a cycle like this. There have been some efforts, and usually they're just limited. And there's some new efforts going on. It hasn't gotten to a point where it has its own momentum to keep going. Now, we have a chance with 200 people coming in next week, I guess it is, to the Mosaic German American Bank building. That's going to hopefully be enough. And then there's something going on at the telephone building in the same block on 7th Street. They finished it or are just about done with it, okay? And both those, there's a new parking lot. The parking lot's been totally redone across from the Missouri Theater, and the parking lot next to the telephone company building has been redone. You have a new restaurant, Jake's, right across from there, and that building has a mural on it, so it has the potential to have some more development in it. It's a fairly big building. You have all these little small shops that are still available or could be available along Felix Street, and if I don't know whether 200 is enough to support it or not, but we'll see. And there are some shops running north on 7th Street. There's a cafe right up from the building that should benefit from the 200 people there, Cafe Brioche. So we'll see what happens with the other buildings that are there, the other shops that are there. If they start doing better, then maybe on Francis Street we'll see some more activity. Geno's has expanded. Once the parking lot building gets done over here, that should stabilize all that and provide plenty of excess parking, because it's going to be two or three stories of parking there, plus the little grocery store. It might encourage people to develop more apartments and things downtown. And if that works, then you might see more people living downtown, see more people living downtown. You might see more businesses downtown, see more businesses downtown. You might get people actually coming downtown to do a little shopping. You've still got the banks, and you've still got the courthouse, and the attorneys are all, a large number of them are all still downtown. So there's the potential for growth if people can see a way to make money at it. Somebody needs to buy the apartment complex at 8th and Francis and totally gut it and redo it and make money at it. If they do, more people will come downtown. Then if more people are coming downtown, maybe some of the neighborhoods surrounding the downtown area will start to be revitalized. People want to live closer to where they work. Hall Street could be an area that could be completed, maybe. I know somebody's spending some money on a couple of homes up there right now, but there's still plenty of growth that could be done there. And you need to see areas around here where vacant lots can become new, old-looking homes. And we've seen a couple of people do that. We had an airlines pilot and lawyer, and his wife is a doctor. And they spent, I think, around $1 million on building their old new house on what had been a vacant lot. There's been some interest in developing an old school at Massani and 10th into a craft area. I don't know whether that's still going to happen or not, but it's interesting. There's somebody working on Museum Hill. There's several homes that have been saved there. It's better than it has been, but it needs to go all the way. It needs to be a thriving community. The town is better than it ever was, but it's not as good as it can be. It has a lot more potential.
Explain to me what you mean by better than it ever was.
Well, you go into a neighborhood, and when I bought my house, you could see through the brick. Okay. Now that house is stable. It's been totally tuck-pointed and redone. Has a brand new roof on it, slate. The gutters have been reworked. It's been rewired. It has central air. My neighbor across the street has put the front door back in the house. The neighbor next to me has put stone around his house. The neighbor to my south is taking care of his house, which was a stained glass owner's house, the Wolf house. And he's bought the house next to it, which is an old Carpenter Gothic, and it's stabilized it. He hasn't done anything with it yet, but he stabilized it, put a new roof on it. So the neighborhood is better than it's been. I've uncovered my brick sidewalk instead of letting the grass grow in it. And I'm still working on it, but you know, it's coming along. I've got flowers in the yards. So that block is, you know, is nice, and somebody's trying to save the Cracker House. I personally think it's too late, but because of the amount of money that it can take. It's never too late to save a house. If you've got the money, it can be saved. But you've got to have somebody that wants to save it in the first place. If you're a young person, if you've got enough sense to appreciate history, buying an old house is usually a very good economic deal because you can get it usually cheaper than a new house, okay? And yes, you are not going to have all your conveniences in it. But if you plan to stay there for more than 5 years, you should be able to make enough improvements in it that even if you don't make it your lifetime house, that you can go on and sell it for more than you put into it and buy another house. So it should be a good investment for you. But the problem is finding the neighborhood that's going to get enough people to do it that the neighborhood is going to come along with you. Because one house by itself can't change a neighborhood. So you've almost got to talk up the idea and get friends all going into it together. But you got to play your cards close because you can't let the sellers know what you're doing. It's just got to happen. Because once the sellers know what's going on, they're going to start raising the prices for their stuff. So, and then you've got to have a city that wants you to do these things. We had this wonderful lady here in town who opened up a place called the Gothic Tea House. And it was 2 years of fighting with the city to get it ready and get it opened. And it should never have been that kind of a battle. The city should have been wanting that. And then she bought the house next to her. But she got so fed up with the city that she's got them on the market and she's moved to Georgia and found another community where she can try it again and maybe have better luck. And that's such a shame because the structures of the houses in the block that she bought have a lot of potential. It stepped back again because she's left two good houses, but nothing has happened yet. Nobody's even bought the two houses.
Can we go back to kind of the downtown area when you were younger?
Sure.
And talk about, you know, what was there and how it changed. I know you said you
Well, there were shops. There were shops everywhere, okay. We had a little 80-year-old lady, I think she retired when she was 85, who had half of a city lot. Okay, so city lot's 80 feet, the old ones, 40 feet. Okay, she kept stationery, gloves, and stamps. And any kid or adult who collected stamps in St. Joe went into her shop. The lighting was horrible. And it's very narrow, confined. But she had it all cataloged there, and you could get just about any stamp you wanted. She would have it. And she and her husband had started this business in the 30s. There were shoe shops all up and down. One of the best, of course, was Everett's. And it was there on Felix. Right. Joe Geller, a World War II vet, had opened a men's and ladies' store. Geller's in the old church that was halfway up the block. Okay. You had Kresge's and Woolworth's down on the next block. You had the department stores like the Plymouth, A.J. August, Townsend and Wall. What am I leaving out? You had Weekly's men's store across from Townsend and Wall. You had record stores. You had the Lee's, which was down on Francis Street in the Pioneer Building. You had the bakery. You had the Oakford Tea Room, Mantrex Bookstore, Savings and Loan. You had all the physicians and surgeons in the Physician and Surgeons Building. You had all sorts of offices. All the offices were packed in the Kirkpatrick Building. And you had elevator operators in all of those stores. If there was a floor with an elevator, then they had an operator who operated the elevator for you. Did they make a lot of money? No. But they were a smiling face who greeted you and took you to whatever floor you needed to be on. It made money so you could get by. There were lots of little jobs so that anybody who wanted to work could work. You had all the women's shops, La Mode. You had the jewelry stores, Joe Optikins. The barber shop. There were several barber shops downtown. The streets were always lined with people. In the early morning hours before 9, you could see shop owners out in front sweeping the streets, the sidewalks out to the street. The city would have a street cleaner coming through every morning. You had the mailman who walked the beat and delivered your mail into your shops and talked to you. You had the trolleys bringing people downtown from all over town. You did your doctor visits, your dental visits. You did your shopping for the day, whatever it was you wanted to do that day. Maybe you went by the post office and bought stamps to take home with you. You walked all over the downtown area, and then you went to one of the central locations and caught a bus and went home. And until about from 9 till about 5:30, everything was packed. Every day. And on Friday nights, people would come in from out of town. And Saturdays, and shop. Saturdays, the meatpacking plants would pay their employees in silver dollars or $2 bills so that store owners could see how their employees were coming into their stores with money. You had two papers a day. So you would have the morning paper, there'd be a boy downtown selling papers to people on the streets. You had taxi cabs. So you could take a taxi anywhere in town. Yellow cabs. And you had a cat's pharmacy downtown. That was a chain, but you still had all the neighborhood pharmacies. And what you began to see is chain development. With the mall, you see JCPenney's moving out of downtown area into the bigger store and more competition for the local department stores. You see Sears, they don't do that till the 90s. They come out there too. But you see chain stores starting to come in and instead of local stores, which makes it more difficult for the local stores to survive. Now, and that's the start of the chains. Then the big supermarkets start to come in. And you get the big Kroger's and the Safeways and they get bigger and bigger and bigger until you've got Hy-Vees and what you've got today. Even the Green Hill stores today is bigger than it was when I was a kid. You have a lot more choices. Some things are still fairly reasonable in price, but it's not like it was. I mean, you have bigger refrigerators. You used to buy for a day or maybe a week, but that was tops. Now I may go in and buy, when I go to Sam's Club, I buy for 3 months maybe, because I don't want to be going back there every week. You go to the grocery store, you buy for a month. The only things you want to go buy weekly might be milk and a few perishable items. So, but the shoe repair shops. There were four or five shoe repair shops around town. You bought a pair of shoes just because the bottoms wore out. You didn't get it, throw them away. You got them repaired and kept on wearing them. You could wear a pair of shoes for 20. You could still wear any good shoes for 20 years. You just might have to get them repaired. But it's you got to go look for somebody to do it. And it's much more expensive than it used to be. I don't think this necessarily is a bad shoe, but it's not a shoe for 20 years. You bought your clothes. You expected them to last. Your coats, for example, and stuff like that. Now you buy jackets and run in and out and get new ones all the time. And we become more commodity conscious than we used to be, I think. I don't see the reason for all the instant knowledge. Some of it's nice, and for certain types of jobs, it's super. But I don't have a computer at home. I wouldn't have a cell phone if the company didn't buy it for me. I don't need to be talking to people all the time. I don't need to be bombarded all the time. You need a little time to relax and think. I don't see a TV in every room in my house. I appreciate the desire to know and stuff like that, but basic rule in our house is you don't call anybody after 9 o'clock unless it's an emergency. And you don't call anybody in the morning before 8 o'clock. That's just the way we were brought up. We keep going through phases and all, but we seem to want to get bigger and bigger stores. And we see, in the beginning, you see a whole bunch, and then they get bought out and bought out and bought down and bought down until there's... It's just the way it is. I don't know that I like it, but it's just the way it is. But it's a shame that there's not a way for people to start and run more small businesses. They may not get wealthy, but they ought to be able to earn a living. We'll see. I don't know. That all goes back to, are we on the right road to go down to grow the downtown? We've tried everything in the book. We just need a healthy, thriving bunch of business owners who are willing to take the risk and put the businesses in down there again. I can tell you a little bit. I mean, I've studied the city directories and things. I mean, we had hundreds of saloons in town, of bars in town, okay, at the beginning of the 20th century. But it was largely because we had breweries in town. And the breweries would pay you to open a bar. They would bring in the bar, they'd bring in tables and chairs and things like that, you know. I think they'd even bring in pictures. Because what ran the bar and what made the bar a success was the person. And it was if you were going to have a successful bar, you had to be there and be involved with your customers. There was a wonderful little restaurant. The building is still there and it's still a restaurant, but it doesn't have what it had before, called Jim's Place at 22nd and Francis Street. It's another example. The two guys that ran it were there every day. They talked to you. They knew you. You knew them. And they knew how to serve food quick and good. And you could eat your lunch hour there and be back at work on time. They were packed all the time. The new guy hasn't quite learned that yet. And it's been opened and failed several times after they left the business. You go down to what was a drugstore there at 25th and Massaney, and you've got Pappy's now. And it's Pappy's because Pappy is there every day, basically. I mean, you know, he does take a vacation every now and then, but he's there every day talking to you, keeping the flow going and making sure everything's running smoothly and you're getting the service you deserve. It can still, I guess what we're saying is it can still happen. One of the great examples of that, by the way, is the Ground Round. For years, they were out there at the Belt and Frederick, the busiest intersection in town. Every economist will tell you that that's the place to be, you know. But it got too expensive. So what did she do? She moved downtown. And what happened? She's making twice as much money as she ever made. She's doing just fine. Her customer base followed her. And on top of that, she built a base. And she's still growing. And her overhead is dramatically cut because she's not out there at the high-placed corner. She welcomes Jakes. She welcomes Boudreaux's. She doesn't oppose them. She can't serve everybody. She knows she can't serve everybody. The more restaurants you have, the more people you have. So maybe you go to Jake's this time, and next time you go to Boudreaux's, but maybe the next time you'll go to Ground Round. The same thing. There are other little Geno's, like, you know, they seem to think this is the right time. So they bought the building next to them and have expanded dramatically, doubled or tripled the space they have. And it'll be because the owners are down there. And everybody's talking to you, and you feel like it's a place you can walk in where everybody knows your name. You know, that's nice. And the CVB is moving to a new location there downtown, where maybe they'll get more business there. I don't know. We'll see. But it is a nice addition to that neighborhood. We just have to see. But we seem to be going right. If you've never been in it, there is a wonderful row of shops on 7th Street between Jewel and Francis. It's Donnell Court. It doesn't... No, that might not have the right name. That may be what they call the building down the street. But there is a early 20th century... shopping mall, and it's all offices. Go in and see what it looks like, because it's right out of pre-World War II, and it's still being used. So, and we even saw Mocan start to take the veneer off their building and show you what a wonderful building it is underneath. So that there's potential there. We'll just have to see.